picking up on one theme in particular, which we've been discussing this morning, and that is the idea of this unconditioned, or the deathless, or nirvana. And the enormous amount of confusion that these ideas have generated. Now, what all these concepts have in common is the fact that they are describing the absence of something. When you say unconditioned, it means not conditioned, not born, not made, or nirvana, blown out, no craving, no desire, no greed, absence of hatred, absence of fear. In other words, the Buddha spoke about at least this one element of the Four Truths. We'll come back to the Four Truths this afternoon. As the dropping away of something, the absence of something. What I think has happened is that this absence has very often been reified. In other words, it's been made into a thing, something that's not an absence, but actually something rather positive. The unconditioned, capital U, seems to be some sort of greater reality, perhaps, not that of the conditioned world. I think the Buddhist thinker who shed for me the most light on the meaning of nirvana, or the unconditioned, is a figure who's not very well known in Western Buddhist circles, called Dharmakirti. Not to be confused with Chandrakirti, who's fractionally better known. Dharmakirti lived, if I remember correctly, in about the 5th or 6th century after Christ, so about 1,000 or more years after the Buddha. And he's credited, together with his teacher Dignaga, for having established the form of epistemology and logic, or formal logic, formal epistemology, that became the framework for a lot of Buddhist critical thought that then developed into the Madhyamaka and other schools. But we're not going to get into that. Dharmakirti describes himself as a Sautrantika, is the term he uses, which literally means a follower of the suttas, or the sutras. It's nowhere in the writings of Dharmakirti or among any of the scholars who work on his work have I been able to ascertain which sutras in fact they're referring to. I'm going to suggest, without any real backup, that Dharmakirti wanted to get back to the original intent of the suttas, the early canon. That's my hypothesis. But it doesn't really matter. The point is that Dharmakirti also introduced a way of thinking about nirvana, the unconditioned, and so on, which again is, on first hearing, rather shocking, rather surprising. Dharmakirti, like most Buddhist thinkers after the Buddha, used these terms ultimate truth and relative truth, samati, paramata satya and samuti satya. And I mentioned I'm not terribly keen on these ideas, but nonetheless, that's the way that Dharmakirti worked. But in doing so, he subverted what we normally would assume to be meant by an ultimate truth and a relative truth. We normally think the ultimate truth is the unconditioned, or emptiness, or true mind, or something transcendent, something that doesn't change. And relative truth we think of as the changing, phenomenal, dukkha-ridden world of our lives, the phenomenal world. Dharmakirti turned that upside down. For Dharmakirti, what was ultimately real was everything that changed. To be an ultimate truth for Dharmakirti means it had to be impermanent. That by definition. Another characteristic of ultimacy for Dharmakirti is that An ultimate truth is something that he described as Dernje Nuba in Tibetan, which means able to generate effects and meanings. So an ultimate truth is something that does something. So an example of an ultimate truth would be, and the classic example is, a seed. A seed will, once it's set in the proper conditions, will produce effects. It will produce a sprout and then a tree. That is an ultimate truth. It's never the same for two consecutive moments, which is Dhammakirti's definition of impermanent. It's not, doesn't remain the same for two consecutive moments. It is necessarily causative, and at the same time necessarily the consequence of previous causes. It's both a cause and an effect. So a seed is the product of a plant that has produced seeds, and that seed will then produce other plants. This is Dharmakirti's understanding of what is ultimately true, the changing phenomenal world. So what then is relatively true? Relatively true, or conventionally true, are things that do not produce effects in the way that causal processes do, and also things that are true only because there are human beings to conceptualize them. See, an ultimate truth does not require the human observer to bring them into being. Let's say, for example, that all human beings... Let's imagine a time before there were human beings, before there were language, before there was ideas. There were trees, there were sprouts, there were fishes, there were all of these things that were involved in this causal process of dependent origination. And for those things to keep having their effects, to do their thing, did not require human beings to know that or to be involved in any way. A relative truth or a conventional truth only exists as a human concept. These things exist, but only conceptually. Now, the classic example, well, I won't give the classic example because it's a bit abstract. An example would be the absence of an elephant in this room. Now, it's true that there is no elephant in this room, I don't think. Am I wrong? No. The absence of an elephant in this room exists, but it only exists because human beings have the sorts of minds that can establish that fact. If a dog walks into the room, the dog will not notice that there's no elephant. Human being, if so inclined, let's say there's no Zen master in the room. There's no almost infinite things in the room. And the fact that they don't exist is true. And those absences exist. Do you get this? Kind of going to make a rather important point in a minute. That is the nature of an absence. An absence is only conventionally real. In other words, it is the product of convention, of language, of thought, of concepts. But it doesn't exist in and of itself. The absence of an elephant is not going to generate baby absences of elephants. Right? It only exists because we can conceive or we can legitimately say there is no elephant in this room. Now, that is an example of an absence. And remember, the Buddha speaks of nirvana, the unconditioned, blah, 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 as absences. Ontologically, in other words, in terms of what these things are, they're no different from the absence of the elephant in the room. The absence of craving, the absence of confusion, the absence of suffering, these are concepts. Nirvana, the absence of greed, hatred, delusion, as an absence, that is just an idea. It doesn't exist in and of itself. It's not a thing. In that sense, it's only conventionally real. And when I first heard this, I found it very weird, because I've been told totally the opposite. But this is very, one of the most, probably the most important Buddhist thinker ever, in my mind, enormously influential, without whom all Buddhist philosophy as we know it wouldn't have existed. And here he is saying nirvana is just an idea. What is really real is the impermanent changing world. Now what's all this? All the idea, anatta, no self, not self. It's just an idea. It's just a concept. It's not a reality in any real sense at all. Let me illustrate this with an example. When Martine and I bought our house in France, we had in the backyard a atelier, a work shed, a shed. And this was a thing that her great uncle had built in order to store some German post-war industrial machinery used in the shoemaking trade. And so we bought this property, and in it was a shed full of this useless, antiquated industrial equipment, completely useless. The shed was only about a few feet from the back of the house. So it meant that it created a constant little avenue of damp and dark, because it prevented the sun getting directly into the lower part of the house. And as time went by, it became overgrown with honeysuckle and ivy. So it became increasingly dank and horrible. And the only reason my mother-in-law and my grandmother-in-law didn't want to get rid of it was because it was where the feral cats had their kittens every year. So this thing remained. As also part of rural French culture is that you never get rid of anything just in case it might come in useful one day, I suppose, including antiquated German industrial machinery. So the thing was just there. It cut out the light, it created this rank passage. And as soon as we bought the property, one of the things we wanted to do once the flat was sorted out was get rid of the shed. So we did. Eventually, a friend of ours who needed the wood agreed to come and dismantle it. We got a scrap metal merchant to take out the machinery. And then within a matter of a few hours, the thing was gone. And the garden was transformed, the house was transformed. In the absence of this shed. Right? The absence of the shed. And for several days, I rejoiced in the absence of this shed. And I would go into the garden and stand where the shed had once stood and enjoy and celebrate what had been opened up. You could see things you could never see before. In addition to which, the house suddenly was full of light. And that dank passage was a memory. It was wonderful. It was liberating. It was transformative. And yet it was just the absence of a shed. After 3 or 4 days, I could no longer get that hit of no shed. And nowadays, it's impossible. I can't go and stand there and think, no shed, no shed. They didn't. For some time, when we had guests, I would take them and say, you know, there used to be this really horrible shed. As though they could appreciate, also, that there was no shed. So after a while, it just becomes normative, and you get on with the gardening and enjoying the light that comes in the house. Now, this is, I think, very similar to the experience of no self, or of no something unconditioned, unfabricated. For Dharmakirti, to experience no self means to experience the five aggregates minus self. The five aggregates, the body, the material world, feelings, perceptions, impulses, consciousness. Once you take this idea of a fixed ego out of that equation, you experience the aggregates in a way you never have before. The aggregates, or the phenomenal world, opens up for you. It's illuminated, it's enriched, it's enhanced. And this is the reason why Dharmakirti says that it's the phenomenal world that is really real. The world that we observe when we practice mindfulness, when we pay attention to the breath, to the sensations of the body, And we try to do so with noticing their impermanence, noticing that they're not me or mine. Do you see? I think it's Dhammakirti's philosophy is very in tune with the whole practice of Vipassana, because it too shows that by noticing the phenomenal, changing, suffering world, which is not intrinsically me or mine, that illuminates the world, it brings it to life in a way that very often you'd never really noticed before. And I'm sure if you've been on retreats, this is often an experience we have, that after a while, when we begin to get into this, everything becomes somehow enriched, illuminated. We can spend, you know, we can just stare at a leaf or a flower or the grass or the colour of the sky, because something has somehow dropped away, some sort of obsessive, neurotic view of things or attachment or fear or craving or hatred or whatever it is. When these things begin to fall away, when they become momentarily absent, then in their absence, the world is enriched. The world is enhanced. The world is in a sense, re-enchanted, almost. And this is what I think Dhammakirti is getting at. That the emphasis for Dhammakirti is not on the experience of nirvana, the absence of the shed. There are moments when you suddenly notice that that crap is not there anymore. And that, like the removal of the shed, you can somehow experience as a kind of illumination, a kind of transformation. But once it's gone, once you get used to the world without shed, without ego, without craving, it's just the ordinary world. That's the world of your life. That's the world in which you live. And so in this way, we find a manner of thinking about the unconditioned, rather than as some mystical, wonderful thing. Rather in the way the Buddha spoke of it, I teach you the unconditioned. It is the absence of greed, absence of hatred, absence of delusion. In other words, it's the removal of what prevents us from experiencing the world through the senses in a rich, immediate way. For Dhammakirti, as an epistemologist, direct sense experience is what he calls pramana. In other words, optimal cognition, optimal non-distorted cognition. And whether he speaks of pramana as sense experience, or whether he speaks it as what he calls yoga pratyaksha, which means like direct meditative experience, it has the same level of validity on a cognitive level as seeing a rose as a rose. So we start moving into what we might think of more as Zen. You know, this sort of immediacy, directness of simple, ordinary, everyday objects. Unfortunately, Indian philosophy has a tendency to always remain abstract, always to remain very much at the level of ideas, and rarely to translate those ideas into a much more sort of concrete, immediate description of things. I think Buddhism had to go to China and Japan before it began to find that kind of almost poetic language, which celebrated the immediate. Nonetheless, I find that this way of looking at ideas such as nirvana, unconditioned and so forth, and emptiness, takes away the idea that those are the things you meditate on. Emptiness or not self, you never meditate on those things or observe those things. They're not observable. You can only observe phenomenal events like the breath or the pain in the knee or the flowers in the tree, and you can notice that they are not me, not mine. You can notice that they are not permanent. You can notice that they are poignant, unreliable, whatever, but you're not meditating on not self or on impermanence. It's impossible to meditate on impermanence. It's just an idea. It's a useful idea, however, in the same way that not self is a useful idea, in the same way that getting rid of an ugly old shed is a useful thing to do. It likewise removes something that enables you to see and to experience the world minus that obstructive element. And I found that useful, and I hope that as we continue this afternoon that you'll keep that image in mind, because that's essentially a description of the third noble truth. That is a description of the third noble truth, minus mystical elaborations. Much loved of human beings. Would an hour be long enough for lunch? So it's 12:30, we'll start again at 1:30.